Thank you. Okay, so I'll talk about a new approach towards finding, transcription factor binding sites that seems to be more appropriate for those transcription factors that has that have many, many targets, right? The transcription factors like global regulators. And I should also introduce myself. I'm Anirvan Sengupta. I'm Department of Physics at Rutgers, and I'm also in this new interdisciplinary institute called Biomaps Institute. And I kind of realized there is a significant fraction of the population in the room who belongs there. So, and this work started actually a few years back when at Bell Labs, Boris and I were thinking about why some motifs are more fuzzy than others, and we tried to build some kind of evolutionary model. And then Marco and Boris and I worked on this problem, and but quickly it became a bioinformatics problem, which I'll talk about today. So one thing is that we have had two talks on transcription things, and actually Said did a great job of introducing things, so I'll not introduce anything at all, unfortunately. And also Eric has talked about transcription. Yes. So I'll be very brief, and I'll be quick. I'll very briefly introduce what global regulators we are thinking of and the issue of DNA binding specificity for those proteins. I'll talk mostly about E. coli, and then I'll sort of go ahead and discuss what do you need to do specially for such transcription factors when you want to do bioinformatics and predict binding sites. And finally, I'll discuss some experimental efforts that are beginning at Rutgers, where in Biomass we have a lab. So here are some examples of global regulators in E. coli, meaning transcription factors that control many, many genes. And some of these transcription factors you have heard about in the course of the workshop. I guess John Little talked about, like, say, David Lowe might have talked about LRP. We will talk quite a bit about CRP or CAP, as it's called. It's a transcription factor that in fact tells the bug it's actually hungry, that glycolysis isn't going very well, and of course turns on or off many, many genes. Okay, but of course this method is more general, and we'll discuss this. Okay. So just to briefly orient the things, and most of you know about it, so I don't need to spend much time about it. This is sort of a textbook example of control of an E. coli gene, okay? And you'll see a very general theme here, how a local regulator, a regulator that controls very few genes, combined with a global signal, okay, controls genes in E. coli, okay? And like, so it said that most of the E. coli genes receive inputs from very few transcription factors, right? So this is the case where you have to turn on a bunch of genes necessary to digest lactose, and you need two pieces of information for that. One is lactose is present, and that information comes through removal of a protein called repressor, okay, from here, unblocking the site. But then there is a generic, there's a sort of global signal necessary, which says maybe not that much glucose, okay? Which leads to sort of rise in a level of something called CMP. It binds to a particular protein called CAP, which will then act as an activator and capture the polymerase, okay? So now you can guess that that's of course being used in many other genes too, right? So if you look at binding sites of the two proteins I just mentioned, okay, you will see sort of very different patterns. LACI, the repressor, has, it's believed that there are only three binding sites, okay, three biologically relevant binding sites in the E. coli genome. And these three are those sites, right? And if you really wanted to predict or search for LACI binding sites, you didn't have to work very hard. You could pretty much take this chunk of the sequence with a gap, that chunk, okay, which is conserved among all three, and you would have found all of them, okay, right? Look at, so for CRP, we know 50 to 100 binding sites by various means. okay? And if you look at them, okay, you will see that these sequences are much more variable, okay? The consensus sequence, the sort of best binding sequence is something like that. And some sequences are somewhat close to that, somewhat far away. And the important issue is how to characterize such fuzzy motifs, okay? And so if you want to predict, you have a way of sort of, you know, characterizing and defining what these fuzzy motifs stand for. And some of that we actually saw inside stock, okay? One of them in this output of LINS, if you remember, there was a soup of letters other than ACGT. And this is sort of the literate way of going about it, which is every time you see a certain combination of bases, invent a new letter, and the origins of these letters are somewhat interesting. But if you really now have to look for a strong CRP binding site, you can go look for something like this, but that will miss most of them, because this TGTGA, TCA, these are kind of strong signals, and quite often you deviate from there. You can come up here, but this doesn't capture many things. Like if you make a mistake at every place, you would most probably not bind, okay? So these kind of rules, okay, are not very good at picking out what are good binding sites and what are bad binding sites. So there is a little bit more quantitative way of going about it, which again, referred to called weight matrix. And since it was given a very short shrift in all the talks, right, I'll briefly describe what this is about. So this is the kind of more numerate way of doing things. So you kind of take those sequences, align them up, decide, for example, for the first position, for these motifs, what is the frequency matrix table, right? What is ACGT frequencies are like? And then that way you get sort of length of the motif times 4 size matrix. Now you can take a log of that. That will give you some numbers. If you have more occurrences of a certain site, the log would become a little bit bigger. There ought to be a little 1/4 here, but ignore that for the time being. And then for any sequence, you calculate a score, okay? So I had this number, the frequency matrix, I multiplied that by something, took a log, so that gives me the weight matrix, right? And suppose you give me a sequence now, T, T, A, G, C, A, I'll say, okay, the first thing is T. For the position one, I'll take the Tth element of that, right? And I just add up these numbers, and I get a score. And closer you are to the consensus sequence, you get a better and better score. You get a higher W, right? It'll turn out that in some limit for certain type of data sets, some certain crazy type of data sets, there is actually a precise relationship between binding energy and the weight matrix elements, right? Right. And this is the kind of logos that you see, which is kind of a compromise between those inventing new letters and having these numbers. This logo was for CRP binding sites were created in this paper, okay? Right, so the sites where the heights are large, you have pretty conserved bases. This is kind of like entropy for no all equal probable minus the entropy of this distribution, times sort of, and the amount of length a particular letter gets depends on its relative frequency. Okay, anyway, so that aside, okay, what are the problems of weight matrix, sort of going with weight matrix and trying to figure out what the binding sites are? Well, suppose you have calculated some weight matrix, now you have a way of sort of calculating a score for every sequence. Now you go all over the genome, you can calculate the scores, right? So you'll find some sequences which are subsequences which have a very high score, so this is, say, the best. And then you will get somebody which is a little less, and somebody which is a little less, et cetera, et cetera. As you come to lower and lower and lower score, what would happen is that many, many, many different sequences, okay, would sort of produce the same number because, you know, there are lots of cancellations between high scores and low scores, and you will see more and more and more numbers bunching up, right? So if you did a histogram of that, here you rarely get a particular score. In here, sort of, you know, things start piling up, and in here it will almost look like a continuum, right? Now, I have marked in green some of the examples we have started with, right? The you start with a set of motives that are given to you, you align them, and you calculated your frequency out of there, right? Now, to separate or to pick out what motives you think are biologically functional, you have to say, I think, you know, this end of it is where biological functional things are, okay? So for that, you need to set a threshold, okay? Now, you can set the threshold too tight, rather tight. You know these are very strong binding sites, very unlikely things, and you're usually sure that they have a biological significance, right? But if you do that, you're quite often leaving out, okay, most of the examples you have started with, often half the examples you have started out with. You could actually make it very lax and include the last and the worst example that you have. Okay, so this is your example, you calculate the score for it, right? Now, weight matrix has a habit of producing, okay, one or two examples whose score is sort of a bit of an outlier. It's sort of low for some reason. Now, usually, if you include this one, by that time, you have included so many sequences, okay, you are reasonably sure that those are not biologically relevant sequences, okay? And we will actually illustrate this with sort of things done for motifs for particular transcription factors, right? So what we need, at least for transcription factors where there are, actually I've drawn only few, but like thousands or hundreds of hits like this, right? We need a method that not only gives us the weight matrix-like object, but also produces a threshold automatically, right? And also has little less of a tendency of spreading out things deep down. Right? So it should not have too many of these outliers, right? So how can I have such a method? Okay? So for that, you first need to ask, what is it that separates, okay, these biological sites from the others, and how do you say these are sort of, you know, binding sequences, and then these are sort of generic random things in the background. So if you think a little bit about what goes into very elementary biophysics or biochemistry, whatever you call of binding, it becomes clear what are the relevant variables, and then it becomes very clear what to do, okay, to figure out parameters needed to classify this thing. So we do something, so let's take one of the more popular models for, you know, a biophysical description of transcription factor binding to DNA. And this is the so-called independent nucleotide model, right? So what that says is that imagine there is a transcription factor, and imagine these are little amino acid side chains trying to contact DNA, right? So for a particular position, there is a window of, say, I've drawn like seven bases here. And each base contacting this protein, okay, if it is the first position in the window, it gets a certain amount of energy, right? And for the second base, you get another bunch of energy. So what you have is that for each position, you have four, well, I'll be sloppy about energy and free energy, so I'll just keep on calling that energy, okay? So for every position, there are four numbers telling you how much free energy you gain by contacting the protein at that particular position, okay? So again, as an example, if I have this particular sequence, it will be a sum like that, okay? Which will be elements of that matrix picked up, and we can write that in the following way. We have epsilon IB telling you the energy you get if the ith position has B at base, and I multiply that by some funny thing called SIB, which actually characterizes the sequence. So SIB is a matrix which has sort of columns of four in which you put a one in the position that corresponds to the base. So if it's all A, it will be 1000, 1000, okay, if it is, okay. So you can think of this as a matrix times a matrix transpose trace, or you can think of epsilon as a big, big, big vector with four L elements, okay? And think of this as a dot product of two such vectors, okay? And you can think of it either way, right? So now I have told you, suppose I gave you those parameters, okay? You can go ahead and figure out, if I go over all sequences of that length, what would be the distribution of the energies, right? So it will be some single hump distribution like that generically, right? And there would be sort of the minimum here, the maximum here, and some kind of hump in between. Now we want to say, so we care now about protein binding, right? And now we can ask, what part of this distribution or what sequences are binding to the protein, right? Now that question, of course,
sorry, I don't understand the schedule. This is
Oh, I'm sorry. This is the histogram of binding energies that you will run, will get, okay, if you go over all sequences. So suppose I have a length L motif, I have 4 to the L sequences. I can ask, what are these 4 to the L numbers I get, okay, for contact with protein, right? So my model produces 4 to the L numbers, right? And now I try to plot them, okay, as a histogram, right? I've drawn it as a continuous thing, but yeah.
But what should it look like? A unimodal Gaussian?
Yeah, well, the point is that if L gets, okay, fine. So if L gets to be large, which is like 22 or something, it's becoming sum of many, many, many variables.
So they're really independent.
Well, if I do 4 to the L sequences all together, that distribution, of course, is independent IID. I could have chosen slightly biased distributions, but even then I can make the basis independent.
Okay.
Okay? Right.
What though if there's evolutionary pressure against meaningless sites? For example, you mentioned there are 3 lac sites, and let's just suppose the expected number was 8 in the E. coli genome. I don't know what it is, but suppose that there was a slight evolutionary pressure which would affect the tails of the distribution, which is really what you're most interested in and where the Gaussian distribution is going to be most.
I'm not insisting on the Gaussian distribution. The question was of a single hump.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
but as you will see, I'll show you examples, okay, where you will see a pileup actually compared to the independent-like distribution, okay, on the tails.
I just because there's evolutionary pressure against meaningless sites. In other words,
at this moment, it's all math. Yeah. So this is not a genomic distribution.
In a real genome. Is it possible that meaningless sites, which occur with a certain frequency, or dysfunctional sites, might be evolved against?
Well, actually, what happens quite often is that you deplete a little from here, and actually you build up something there, which is something I'll show. So it's a good question, but as we see it, the crude picture is that it actually gets more good stuff if it needs to regulate genes, okay, rather than trying to kick things out, but maybe it does kick it out. It's just that, you know, getting unnatural sequences, okay, overcompensates for any such effect, at least in most cases, okay? So but we can discuss this in more detail. Okay, so what I wanted to come to is the question of protein binding now, okay? So if you just work out the equilibrium between, you know, transcription factors in the solution, binding to DNA and coming off, et cetera, you will find a formula like that. Right? It should be proportional to the concentration of the factor going in, okay? And e to the minus beta e roughly tells you how much free energy you get, and k is this unknown ratio between plus and minus in some sense, right? So this, of course, as n increases, or if n is very small, nobody binds. If n increases, becomes 1 at past some point, right? But there is sort of a slightly different way of writing the same thing, where we focus more on the energy than on the N. Okay? So if you make mu, I call it the chemical potential, which will be KT log N, you can sort of write this as 1 minus E to the beta E minus mu plus 1. This function has a property that if E is much less than mu, okay, so you are in this sort of high binding energy tail, your binding probability is nearly 1, right? But as you go past this threshold, okay, it becomes nearly zero. It becomes exponentially decaying here, okay? And higher up, you'll not have much of probability of binding, okay? So what this says, of course, is that the threshold separating good binders and bad binders is, of course, concentration dependent, something that we know, right? If you jacked up the concentration of transcription factors or active transcription factors under a certain physiological condition, the threshold would move somewhere higher up. And the biologically interesting question of figuring out all the binding sites, at least, has to do with what is the maximal physiological concentration that you are talking about, okay? So imagine, you know, the bug gets only so hungry, you can figure out how many CMP bind CRP you have max, Okay, so that will set the threshold for us, okay, for figuring out all the biological things. So, but once we have gotten that, there is. Okay, we can simplify it a little bit further. Okay, so in here, the way I have drawn it, and I have drawn a terrible Fermi function, but basically, the width of this thing, this drop-off region is about a kT. Now, the width of this distribution usually is 10 times kT, at least, if not more. Okay, sometimes 20 times kT, right? So somehow, this crossover region is not so important. So we can actually pretty much replace it by an on or off model. Okay. And the energy threshold still being the chemical potential still being determined by the concentration. So I will talk as if I know this mu, okay, and I'll ignore the sort of smoothness of F around it, okay. So now, right. So I have sort of explained how things work, provided you knew these parameters epsilon. Okay, so if I knew the whole binding energy matrix, right, we could have predicted, given a sequence, what's the binding probability at a certain concentration, da 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 da, right? Now the problem is that we don't know these parameters, okay, and we need to figure out what these parameters are, right? So how do you do that? So one painful way may be take one sequence, mutate it a little bit, measure affinity, measure affinity, measure affinity, and maybe it's not a bad idea, but it seems like quite a bit of work, right? Now, we can think of maybe slightly higher throughput ways of doing it, right? And one of the ways could be something which we'll call the low stringency selects, okay? And the idea is that you have a certain, you have taken a distribution of random sequences, right? And then you put in the same solution protein at a certain concentration. Okay, some of these proteins bind to some of these DNA pieces, and then somewhere you pick up these proteins, right? You pull them out, you get a bunch of sequences coming with that, right? So at the end of the day, you have, and suppose you have a certain way of reading out the sequences, which actually, amazingly, you have. Okay, so say I have now 100 sequences or 500 sequences, right, that I have, and I know what they are. Okay, so given that kind of information, rather than individual affinity measurement for particular sequences, how do I go about finding out what these epsilon parameters are? Okay, and here is one way to do that. Okay, so I have some sequences. I want to go back to these energy parameters. Of course, I'll determine energy parameters only up to a scale. I cannot determine really how many kilocalories per mole, right? But you can set up a nice maximum likelihood method to determine these parameters. And let me sort of explain slowly what the ingredients are, okay? So you have a set which I call O, looks like zero, okay? But these are the observed set of sequences. So say I have 100 sequences, okay, that I observed in this experiment. What I have to say is, so I first have to get a probability that I observed them, right? And the probability involves two parts. One is I didn't say that I'll put all sequences, all 4 to the L sequences in the solution, so there's a dilution factor. So you have a probability, P, says that you first in the solution. And if you're in the solution, what's the probability that you bind? Okay, that's F, right? So I have a P times F telling me that this will be fished out, okay, when I do this experiment. Okay, and we need this dilution factor for some normalizations, okay? But basically, this factor is saying, if you saw this sequence, please try to keep your parameters in a way so that this is as large as possible, which is 1. Okay? It's trying to push parameters in a way so that the binding energy becomes less than mu. Right? Now, if only these terms had their way, they would put this parameter so far away that everybody would be very, very far away from that boundary. Okay? And they would be the strongest binding sites in some appropriate numbers, right? So you have to put in the fact that you haven't seen most of the genome show up on your screen. And the other factor, which says, who I did not observe has a certain probability of not being observed, does that. And that's just 1 minus P times F, right? So this factor, okay, is okay as long as F is nearly 0. So if for a sequence I did not see, binding probability is very low, F would be 0, and this factor would be 1, and everybody would be happy. On the other hand, a sequence that you did not see, if it shows up below the chemical potential, okay, F becomes 1, you get 1 minus P, you get a penalty for that. Okay? So this term is trying to tell, keep all the known sequences in the binding region. Push parameters so that dot epsilon dot S for each of them is less than mu. Okay? The other term is saying, please don't get anybody else. Push out as many guys as possible above that threshold. Right? Anybody I have not seen, try to push it above the threshold. Okay? So this actually leads to, I actually pretty much described in words. Okay, the same thing. This term says that, you know, keep all the binding energies below the threshold, otherwise the log doesn't like zeros. Okay? And this term, okay, pretty much counts how many, if I chose a sequence randomly, right, what chance it has to fall below, okay, the threshold, right? So pushing everybody out is pretty much done if you arrange that a random sequence chosen, okay, have very low probability of falling below the threshold mu. Okay? So I'm nearly done explaining. Okay? And this is where you might catch me about Gaussianity or not. Okay? But so what we should have done is actually set down these constraints that all the binding sequences have to be less than mu, which are a bunch of linear inequalities, and should have worked very hard to reduce the probability under the tail. Right? And we'll be cheap there. We'll say, okay, we can do that, but maybe I'll do something else. I'll just reduce the variance of this distribution. Okay? And this is true if this thing is close to the Gaussian region. Okay? That they are exactly the same. But this is a valid procedure for doing something, and we'll see what the result is. Right? So if you have a very wide variance, right, then you have lots of weight under mu. Okay? If you have a very tight distribution, you know, this probability would be less. Okay? Now, why do we want to particularly reduce variance? Because the variance over those 4 to the L sequences, I can write down an exact expression for, right? It is a simple quadratic function of these parameters epsilon I alpha, right? And now I am into a region where I don't have to write any more code, take somebody else's stuff, okay, and get going, right? So what we have reduced this problem to is minimize the variance, which I write as epsilon square, which is under some, with some other constraints, it's epsilon IAB square pretty much summed over all elements, right? Subject to a bunch of constraints, which are like epsilon dot SA is less than mu, and I scale mu to minus 1 because I'll never know the overall scale, okay? So what I have is a bunch of linear inequalities. There are hyperplanes in the epsilon space saying, stay on the good side of it, okay? Several hyperplanes together cut out some kind of convex region. Okay, going up to infinity. And then you say, what is the closest point to origin? Okay, from there. And this kind of problem is regularly solved by quadratic programming and is part of the toolbox of a particular kind of pattern finder called support vector machines. Okay? And the reason for this name, support vector machines, is the following. Okay, so I was talking just now in epsilon space. But think of a space where these vector S's live. Okay, so sequences are represented as little dots on some 4L dimensional space now. Okay, so I have these lots of dots here, lots of sequences. And 1, 2, 3, 4 are my example sequences. Now, epsilon dot S equal to mu is a hyperplane in that space, right? If I put the hyperplane at origin, I've declared half of the sequences, okay, to be my good binding sites, right? So trying to reduce that, I just push out the hyperplane, and at some point it gets stuck to certain examples. Okay? But what is interesting about this method is that it gets stuck to only some examples. Some others actually stay away from the boundary. And what it actually signifies is the following. Suppose by looking at a few sequences, you've already figured out, say, what the consensus sequence is. Telling you the consensus sequence in addition to that should not change your parameter estimation. Right? Because if I think of this in the maximum likelihood way, I'm trying to find parameters which will improve my likelihood, right? Probability of those strongly binding sites are not changing if I change epsilon. So, in fact, what should happen is that the guys who are marginal, who with little change of parameters can cross over from binding to non-binding, those are the ones that should determine the parameters. And that's very different from weight matrices. Weight matrices tend to be much more easily affected by things which are below. Okay? Okay. So So to just go on and ranting about sort of weight matrices, okay, weight matrices would have been the right procedure, provided if I started from this maximum likelihood method, provided the concentration was so low that each site, the probability of binding was like e to the minus beta e. It was in the tail. So if I had the chemical potential below the lowest possible binding energy, right, then instead of a Fermi function, you would have seen an exponential dependence. And in that case, it makes a lot of sense to take log of abundances, because every base would be seen with the probability e to the minus beta e times the energy contributed by that base. Okay? So fine. So the maximum likelihood method actually leads to weight matrix if you are doing the low concentration limit. But really, what we are talking about as reasonable binding experiments or biological sites are sites that are bound with probability nearly one, if not almost, okay, in physiological conditions. Okay. So far I had been talking as if I had an ideal experiment, randomized sequences, and I pick up, and this method seems to be ideal for that. Okay, for doing some kind of low stringency selects. But, well, we are gearing up to do that, and I'll mention that a little bit, but we haven't done anything on that. But on the other hand, you can take the random the sequences that are available from literature and try this method instead of weight matrix and see how it compares. Okay, so we actually took some data collected by George Church's lab on about 50 odd E. coli transcription factors from DPI Interact database. We took those examples, now did this alternative procedure. Okay, I don't have much, I can finish some. And you can sort of, figure out your epsilon parameters. And then we can get a few additional sites which are not in the training set and see how well you do on those additional sites. Okay, that gives you an estimate of how many false negatives you're getting. Right? What fraction are you missing in that set? And we can compare that to weight matrix. But the problem of comparing things to weight matrix is that weight matrix, of course, is many different things depending on what threshold you chose. Right? If you chose a very lax threshold, almost any sequence you pass it would be declared as a binding sequence. Right? So we have to actually compare performance of weight matrix for many different thresholds with our method, which comes with the threshold. Right? And the way to do that ideally is by drawing a false positive versus false negative curve. Okay? Now, false negatives, we have a way of estimating this way, with different choice of thresholds, how many false negatives you get. False positives are much harder, right? Because that's really it's actually an experimental question. Right? But what we do is sort of, as a proxy, take the size of the list. So if you have too many false positives, okay, your list size is most probably very big. You most probably got the whole genome in your list, okay? But the other way around is not always true, okay? But we will first see what happens if you do that.
Can you see make the same number of total positions in the genome and then to see how much?
Yes, okay, yeah. Well, so maybe you're asking the same thing. Ask me again if it was a different question, okay? So here is number of candidate sites we get by looking in the intergenic regions. Okay, and here are the fraction of false negatives, okay, tested on, and this is for a particular protein, CRP, okay, right? This is what the weight, I should have called it QPMEM, okay? Without a good acronym, you don't go anywhere these days, okay? So this new quadratic programming method actually does. So it provides a threshold. We have 1 point. For fun, you can also vary the threshold on that and see what happens. This would be weight matrix. For many different thresholds, and if you look at the paper by Robison, McGuire, and Church, they think about two thresholds. One threshold is where you take this set that you got your weight matrices from, you calculate the average score. Okay, so if you calculate the average score, it means you are sometimes half or more things, okay, are actually outside that threshold, right? And that's this very very tight threshold. Okay, so you got a very short list, but of course you miss, almost 75% of things, right? You can do something where you say mu, you take the mean score and you do that minus twice to the standard deviation, right? That's a more lax threshold. It still leaves out some of your examples and you are somewhere out there. Okay, now, okay, you have gotten a list which is like going to be 3,000 CRP targets is getting to be borderline, okay? Because, you know, the number of metabolic genes, right? And of course, I think they might have considered mu minus 3 sigma, but, you know, you dare not put mu minus 3 sigma and not the maximal one, surely, right? You'll get too many, right? Now, I would say the fair comparison is somewhere here. If we fix the number of false negative, same rate of false negative, we'll get a 800-ish or something list, and they almost really get a 1500-ish list, okay? But what, huh? Actually, Marco has done some such things. Okay, but we will actually, meaning at the end, I will flash a very smudgy gel as our first estimate of rate of false positives. Okay, from experiments directly. But yes, in some cases, actually, I'll come to one case where doing positional things definitely, okay, tells you something. Okay, not about CRP, but about sigma 70, which is part of the polymerase complex. Okay? Yeah, so, right. Okay. So here comes this sort of overabundance question, right? So you can count the distribution of energies you got from your parameters, and then you say, in the genome, now it's a genomic distribution, right? And you can ask, well, let's build a reasonable model for the background. Okay, and the reasonable model for the background ends up involving not only completely independent bases, but at least two side correlated bases, if not more. Okay, right. You can get the kind of theoretical distribution, which is like this, and this is all log. Okay, and you can see the pileup, extra pileup, and it's quite a pileup because, you know, this is all logarithmic, right? And this is the threshold that's automatically chosen. Okay, and I would say very well done, because, you know, normally if I did not know anything about thresholds, we would have tried to set it here, right? But of course, the method is usually more conservative than that. So for another guy, okay, the threshold is a little bit lower, okay, than where there is still statistical significance. Okay, so maybe we can push it up a little bit more. So we are a little bit more on the conservative side, I would say. Okay, right. Now, and these are sort of a huge number of global regulators. I don't expect you to even look at that. CRP is somewhere up there. You can see this reduction happening. Now, for most of them, if you see how much more things have been produced compared to what you expect normalized appropriately by square root n fluctuations, they are quite significant. So this is not a probability, okay, or log of a probability, right? And then there are guys where this number is so-so. Okay, and it's not worth calling them very significant, like order one. Okay, right. But even there, if you start doing this kind of positional informations, okay, you start seeing that we are really not full of false positives. Okay, so here is one such example. So sigma 70 is the part of RNA polymerase complex that actually touches the DNA and it recognizes DNA, has usually two pieces where it touches, which is minus 35 and minus 10. Boxes. One looks like sort of cat, other looks like tatat, okay? So, and as opposed to many of the other factors we talked about, it's not dyadic. It has a particular orientation. So you can always, on a gene, say, this is the minus 35, this is the minus 10, draw an arrow. And you go and hit a gene and ask whether the gene is being transcribed the same way or the other way. If it is being transcribed the other way, then presumably this is not actually controlling that guy. If it is going the same way, it is controlling that guy, possibly. Okay, so then you do a distance from the start of the gene and do a histogram. So this is when the thing is pointing the right way. And you can kind of see a sort of around 30 something. Okay, there is a pileup, which is what would be traditional picture. There's actually no good reason why it has to be exactly at some distance, right? From the transcript start, you have to be roughly at a certain distance, but not from the gene start. But still there is a significant pileup here. This is when it's pointing the other way. Okay, so even if statistical significance by itself did not prove that you are getting lots of biological signatures, by looking at positional distribution, okay, seems to improve situation. Okay, so fine. So here is, so we got moved enough that, you know, in Rutgers we sort of started a lab in which we can do some of these experiments. Okay? So we can do simple things, okay, like gel retardation experiments from something to get some clue about how often you get a false positive. We are trying to tweak and get the conditions right for something like genome-wide location analysis. Okay, it's such something in progress. And finally, we're gearing up to do the CELEX experiments, which hopefully in a month or something, we should see some results. So I will actually be very apologetic, but flash some very preliminary experimental results, just as a ballpark idea of how right and how wrong we are. So these are some binding sites which are randomly pulled out from the list and just made sure that we don't particularly bias ourselves by looking at even which genes they hit or they're not known. Okay? Now here is, these are positions and all, and these are positions of the genes around them. But there is sort of a number which is kind of negative of that energy, binding energy that is associated with each of them. And based on that, you can see this guy is very close to one, means it's almost marginal. Okay? This guy is very close to one. So these three should be nearly marginal. And these guys, these three, should be pretty good binding sites. Okay? And for reference, the CRP binding site near the lac operon is about 1.2, close to this. Okay? And you will see that, you know, all is not perfect.
This okay? From
no, it's not from select. No. This is just bioinformatics prediction. Of the 800, you pick up 6, random sampling from the 800, ones that are not already known in any of the databases as a valid regulator.
Validation, you can also try to look at the function of the gene.
I apologize. I meant to do it this morning, and I have not made it.
The CRP is harder because CRP picks up not a very broad class of gene, but you can look at some other factors that have very specific prediction in terms of function.
Yes. I would say that for CRP, when we had these hits, we looked for, in the annotation, what fraction of this is metabolic genes. And you do get a significantly higher fraction of metabolic genes than you would have in a random pickup. Okay? But it will be very interesting now that you know, actually experimentally, which of these are strong binder and not, to sort of stare around and see which way you guys are pointing and who are you. Okay? We'll do that. Okay? So here is, again, this. We have been saying many times that biologists should not hide ugly-looking data and only get the publication quality gel out. So here is the non-publication quality gel that's out. Okay? And just to guide your eyes, okay, this is the binding site, okay, for the sequence that is there upstream of lac operon. Okay? And you can kind of see it's very hard to read, but in tens of nanomolars, there is a shift starting to happen. Okay, so those are actually not the consensus. The consensus would start shifting at about 500 times less concentration. Okay, but you can see TBS1 was the first example, is a good site. Two,
prediction.
It's a prediction. So this one hit. This two we said marginal. You can see in about 1 micromolar, things are beginning to develop a smudge, and you have to push it to 5 micromolars or something before you see the smudge develop well. Okay, 3 a hit, 6 a hit. This is where I feel like crying. Okay, 4 and 5 has interchanged, and I'm hoping against hope that the two tubes got exchanged. But take the worst possible scenario. Okay, in this case, we would have predicted a marginal one, and we would have said that this one is a reasonable binding site. Okay, so I would say, being very pessimistic and out of this very tentative data, that 5 out of 6 will be qualitatively right. If we predicted them to be binding sites in the list, I will not get beaten up. Okay, and if we are quantitative, we are really trying to say something about the ordering of affinities. Okay, we will be in bad shapes with 2 out of 6. So okay, 30% false positive rate is our very conservative estimate at this moment. Okay. So I'm actually done. Okay, here is a summary. I sort of raised the issue of DNA binding specificity of global regulators, which they have very little specificity, and by tweaking around with the threshold, you can get either 100 targets or 1,000 targets, and you need a method that naturally builds in such thresholds, okay? And it seems like thinking about very elementary biophysics or biochemistry or binding actually provides you a way of doing that, okay? Second is that, so we got this bioinformatic tool, we can improve on it in many, many different directions. Okay, and it's a very, and I would actually like to mention, maybe sort of sticking out my neck a bit, that this may be sort of a more general idea than just transcription factor DNA binding. Because quite often when you get this mass scale, okay, say two protein class interaction or something or the other, you will often have a situation where some cases you have these guys to be nearly marginal and some other guys are very tight binders. Right, and you need classifying methods which are either like logistic regression or like this kind of support vector things, which tries to separate out and not let the parameters be defined, sort of, you know, determined by the ones which are very strong binding, which is kind of binding into saturation, right? So there is a whole new class of things which are essentially different from weight matrix type, take log of frequency kind of, you know, ways of distinguishing things, and depending on your frame of mind. You can decide on the experimental results is whether it's half empty or half full. So I'll call it encouraging. Okay? And before I forget, maybe I should thank the collaborators. So all this work started again in Bell Labs and continued into Rutgers with Boris and Marco. So there is a, and it started with some inquiry into evolution of binding sites. So that's sort of a very interesting subject to us. And so after moving to Rutgers, Boris and I have gotten some money to sort of set up a lab, and Viji Nagaraj is the one who is doing this experiment, and Richard Ebright is the local expert on prokaryotic transcription and has done many important experiments in CRP. Okay, so that's all. Okay, thank you.
Parameters of your fifth model, and is there something biologically
insightful? Oh, no, wait, meaning the parameters, okay, you mean the epsilon parameters? So it does roughly the same things in the region in CRP, which is like looks like TG, TGA, the orderings and everything are the same. Now we can push it a little bit further and make it into physical parameters if we wish to, because if we are taking this seriously, okay, we said, I don't know an overall scale, right? But actually we know the overall scale because we know the affinity ratio of some sequences and the consensus sequence. So I can say, this is the first approximation, I'll improve on it. Let's say up to a scale, these are the energies. Then we can put a number and what is called one would be actually, 1 over 15 would be KT in that thing. So we can actually come up with physical numbers, try to see how many things are bound, and then try to see whether I'm making a mistake and improve on it, put the finite temperature corrections on. And if you sort of count how many contacts there are, et cetera, it's not unreasonable. Okay, but being this is a marquee field already, right? Meaning there are lots of people trying to really realistically model protein DNA interaction.
With the structure
or something. We are hoping that we'll get into some of that, okay? And we also want to sort out this issue of non-specific interaction and really how these things vary, et cetera, et cetera. We can actually do lots of things because we can play with salt concentrations in these binding sites, figure out how things shift, okay? And once we know how to make some of these numbers into kilocalories per mole, we can make other numbers into kilocalories per mole and then be brave and see whether we are right or wrong. So there are lots of things that can be done.
Okay. So I guess we're continuing to.